from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. The Mission District, one of San Francisco's oldest and most artistically vibrant neighborhoods, experienced a cultural renaissance beginning in the late 1960s. Kerry Cordova, author of a new book, The Heart of the Mission, Latino Art and Politics in San Francisco, will join us in studio to discuss the district's history through its muralists, poets, and musicians. She'll also discuss how the Mission's fast-moving art scene has responded to the growth of tech firms and rapid gentrification. That's coming up next, after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. In her new book, The Heart of the Mission, Latino Art and Politics in San Francisco, Kerry Cordova examines the history and political life of one of the city's oldest neighborhoods, the Mission District. She also explores a movement inspired by street art and known as the Mission School that began in the late 1960s, embraced by artists and activists. It includes politically infused street murals, music, poetry, and dance. And Kerry Cordova also explains how the flowering of the Latino art scene grew out of political developments in both California and Latin America. She was raised in San Francisco, now teaches American Studies at the University of Texas at Austin, and she joins us in studio for this Forum Hour. And welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Michael. It's really an honor to be here.
Well, I'm delighted to have you here. And I must say, many of the people who are featured in your book have walked through these doors into the studio, and it was a real pleasure to read about the Mission and about these artists, but also to learn a great deal about the history of, well, politically, as well as the art history of the Mission District. You kind of compare it to Soho and Montmartre and Harlem. I mean, it has that kind of life and vibrancy.
I also, like you, was a student of English, and I learned a lot about the Harlem Renaissance. And I think when I was reflecting on a project that I wanted to do research on, and all these things were happening in the Mission in terms of gentrification, one of the things that I saw was the ways in which there had been a major sort of arts renaissance in the Mission. And that's what I hope to capture. And I think that one of the contributions, sort of lifting off of what you just said, was the ways in which I was hoping that my work would put all of these people together, all of these wonderful artists and talents together into one place, and sort of show the ways in which there was a particular space in which they were all growing and communicating.
It's an extraordinary richness of art and music and poetry, and you know, you capture a lot of it very well, if I may say so, and do so along with some great illustrations and paintings that are here in the book. It does indeed. And we'll get to the displacement of culture and the gentrification. But I want to first take us kind of as you do in the book through the decades. And even before we do that, I want to talk about the Mission School. It is an identifiable school indeed. I mean, it's like San Francisco music almost in a way. San Francisco, you know, we're talking about the music from the Summer of Love. Now we're talking about the Mission School of Art.
Well, the Mission School was adopted as a term to describe a particular generation of artists coming out of the early 1990s and into the 2000s. And it really had a strong appeal in the museum world. Several museums, the Whitney, the DeYoung, many arts writers picked up on the term. And I think that that was one of the struggles that sort of prompted my work, was thinking about the ways in which the Mission arts movement was presented as a post-1990 kind of phenomenon. And so that's why a lot of my work is about that time before.
Well, in fact, I think it was Glenn Helfand in 2002 who gave us that terminology. And what we've seen and see through your book is how everything kind of moved and metamorphosed to that. I mean, you take us into the decades, as I said, and you start talking about the 40s. And I mean, this was a little kind of Latin jazz world unto itself.
Yeah, I mean, that was some of the exciting work of doing research and initially thinking that I was simply writing about the Mission District, which, of course, is exciting unto itself. But then realizing that there was also this other past history. And I kept going a little bit earlier. So I went to the 1950s and Latino artists and the beats. And then I ended up going a little earlier and looking at Latin jazz in the 50s and 40s. And then really landing on another neighborhood that I wanted to look at first before moving into the Mission. And that was the what was known as the Latin Quarter in San Francisco in from really around the 1906 quake until the 1940s and 50s.
Well, the 50s, as you said, is most identified with the beat movement. I mean, Ferlinghetti and Kerouac and Ginsberg and so forth. But a lot of the Latino figures don't somehow fit into this. They're mainly white men. In fact, I had a student named Brendan Knight who wrote a book about the women of the beat movement.
Yes.
And they also have been kind of lost much more than they should have been. Thank heavens for her book. But you've brought a lot of these names back and a lot of the recognition of how they were outsiders, and yet they were certainly influenced, as so many were, by bohemianism and beatnik stuff.
I think that chapter really came naturally to me just because I always looked at my father, who was a native of Albuquerque, New Mexico, Mexican-American, who migrated to San Francisco in the 50s, and a Korean War veteran, like some of the folks that I've actually written about. And I think that I saw the ways in which many Latinos migrated to San Francisco to find a kind of bohemianism or avant-garde, and he was among them. And so even one of the people that I write about was a good friend of his, Jose Ramon Lerma, was an artist friend, and my father used to hang out at some of the galleries over on Green Street. And just sort of thinking about why do we understand the beats as sort of a black and white movement when so many Latinos were there, and also the ways in which the beats really took over North Beach, which was also the Latin Quarter. And so trying to say or think about the ways in which these Latino spaces also became launching pads for a kind of hipsterism, a kind of beat phenomenon.
An avant-garde.
An
extension of the avant-garde. I mean, there was a transatlantic influence there too, but you really bring us into a greater awareness of people like Luis Cervantes, who came here, like your dad from New Mexico. He came from
exactly.
Santa Barbara and after the war and found at the School of Destructivism. This was new to me.
I think you're referring to a story that I love, which is Luis Cervantes. Sort of working class background, coming from Southern California, starting to take art classes here in San Francisco, working with a really great teacher named Seymour Lux, and then making these incredible sculptural pieces, ceramics that were sort of piled high and kind of topsy-turvy, not exactly with a clear definition. And one of the other artists, Ernie Palomino, that I also write about, describing a moment of shock when he watched Luis accidentally tip over one of his sculptures and then seeing that one break, deciding to break every other sculpture in the gallery, throwing all of his work over and sort of trying to figure out, like, what was that? What was that moment? But I also think he was doing it as part of what we understand as destructivism in a sort of art history context, or a sort of fight against commodification, thinking, you know, not about the purpose of selling his work, but about turning his work into a kind of happening.
We're talking, if you just joined us, with Corey Cordova. And Corey Cordova is the author of a new book called The Heart of the Mission, Latino Art and Politics in San Francisco. And there is a direct line here from what was described and is described in your book as the Latin Quarter of the 40s, right on through the more bohemianism of the 50s. And then we get into the 60s and things begin to get very political. And again, you can see the line and the trajectory, and you really delineate it for us quite well. But, you know, many remember the Third World Strike at San Francisco State, Los Siete, the importance of suddenly Cuba and the Black Panthers and the Black Power movement and all this sort of descending on or also arising from the Mission. It was really quartered there.
Yeah, I mean, I think San Francisco State actually had this really unique relationship with the Mission, or the ways in which residents in the Mission sort of used their education at San Francisco State or pushed to think about the ways in which learning in the classroom could be transformative for a community. And so they directed a lot of their activism towards the mission. And so thinking about the ways in which there was, you know, we're looking at 1968, 1969, the years of the Third World Strike, when students are saying it's time to expand the curriculum, it's time to include some sort of Raza studies or Latino studies, Black studies, Asian American studies in the curriculum. And it's time to include people of color at the university. And a sort of remarkable moment, if I could encourage any filmmakers out there, I would really say, look at the Third World Strike. I think it's a sort of amazing moment that's not given enough press. And then the ways in which that sort of activism then launched a kind of narrative of how will we change our community? How will we make it better directly from within?
And suddenly the art begins to reflect all of that. It's not only localized, too, though. It becomes global, you know, in kind of solidarity with struggles in South Africa against apartheid and all of those things that you touch on. But then we go into the 70s and suddenly we have this extraordinary burgeoning of murals. In fact, my friend Tim Drescher, I give him a plug. I haven't seen him in years, but did a whole book on the murals and the mission. And the murals remain, you know, a very strong, not only emblem of Latino identity, but also of the political activism that was so rife and so rich.
Yes, I'll give Tim a plug, too. He was incredibly helpful to me, especially at the tail end. He even helped me with a couple of images. He's really a wonderful resource when it comes to murals here in San Francisco. And I think that having that work also made it possible for me to not just focus on murals, because I think that sometimes people presume that there's an that the art of the mission is all murals. And hopefully in reading my book, people will see that these artists collaborated in multiple genres. They were poets, they were filmmakers, they were writers and visual artists, often even with abstract work, though political posters were obviously incredibly important and had a profound influence on me.
And suddenly urban development plays its central role here. And I'm going to ask you to read from your book, if you would, in the beginning of chapter five, which is called Hombres y Mujeres, Muralists on a Mission, Painting Latino Identities in the 70s, San Francisco. First couple of paragraphs, it seemed to me, you mentioned Alejandro Murguia, who is a poet laureate of San Francisco, who we've featured on Forum. And you also talk about the changing nature of the neighborhood. So we're bringing in what the 70s brought in the way of murals, but also displacement, which would, of course, lead to gentrification. So much of this is tied in. You know, I was resistant at first because I always believe, as Susan Sontag said, that you can't just lump in a way decades. You shouldn't, you know, but you do a really good job of bringing us into understanding this through the decades by separating the decades. She was very resistant to that, and so was I for a while, but you make the case. Could you read the first couple paragraphs?
Sure. Reflecting on the mid-1970s, writer Alejandro Murguia described how San Francisco's Mission District teemed with painters, muralists, poets, and musicians, even the occasional politico or community organizer who acted beyond the rhetoric and actually accomplished something. We had no problem being understood, because La Misión was a microcosm of Latin America, and the whole barrio seemed in perfect sync. Murguia's words expressed the neighborhood's romance, though not everything was in sync. Like many poor urban neighborhoods in the 1970s, the Mission District struggled with development and inner-city neglect. By 1976, nearly half of 260 American cities with more than 50,000 people were experiencing some form of gentrification. In the Mission and elsewhere, the pervasive threat of displacement through development spurred activist responses. Artists turned to murals to invoke community identity and save the landscape from outsider interests, local speculators, crime, and neglect.
And there's the heart of the conflict that we are in now, spelled out so nicely in its nascent way then. The other thing that I think you do a really good job in the book is making us, as readers, aware of just how important struggles in Nicaragua and El Salvador were right in the heart of the mission.
Yes, I mean, I think you sort of touched on it a bit, but sort of the ways in which if you could maybe also fight on all fronts. So thinking about Nicaragua as being an extension of the mission, or thinking about El Salvador as being an extension of the mission, and thinking about what was happening there was also part of what it meant to be living in San Francisco.
And this is a lot of this is really what we call la raza. I mean, the race in terms of an overarching identity, as opposed to silos of Mexican American identity, or Salvador, or Guatemalan, or anything, Nicaraguan, and so forth. It's kind of a great palette of different colors in terms of different cultures.
I think. Yes, that one of the things I also, you know, I've lived in several places. I'm a San Francisco native, but I've lived in Southern California. I've lived in Texas, and I've lived in Pennsylvania. I've lived in many places. And I was always struck by the ways in which a Latino identity felt different in each of those places. And for me, San Francisco had a very sort of cosmopolitan, inclusive sense of Latinos, which meant that you had to acknowledge that there were Guatemalans, Salvadorans, Mexicans, all of these different groups here, as opposed to maybe only looking at a very Chicano-centric identity. And that was something that I really hoped to tackle in some way.
I think, you know, there was a very strong Chicano-centric identity, but yet at the same time, it does represent expansiveness. In fact, let me do this. A lot of you who are listening to this have memories of the mission, maybe even grew up in the mission, have some thoughts, particularly about gentrification, which, as I said, we want to talk about as well. Obviously, we've broached that subject many times here, and displacement of people mm-hmm. who live in this neighborhood, and the really tremendous changes that have gone on as the tech industry has grown and burgeoned. But particularly like the people who've been a part of the Mission District, either art or political. And let me invite you to join us now. You can do that by calling us on our toll-free number available to you. It's 866-733-6786. We'd love to hear some memories, but also some strong memories and emotions about the changes that are going on in the Mission District. And you don't have to necessarily be a native of the Mission to want to weigh in here, but we do want to hear from those of you who either grew up there or have been a part of it. Again, our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. or going right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. You can tweet us as well. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, and you can go to our Facebook page. Many ways available to you to interact with us and become part of this program. And Carrie Cordova is Professor of American Studies at the University of Texas, Austin. Her book, again, is The Heart of the Mission, Latino Art and Politics in San Francisco. And she'll be appearing at the Mission Cultural Center for Latino Arts on Thursday at 6:30 p.m., And here's Jennifer, who writes, to celebrate the mission and its art, there's a party for the 40th anniversary of Presita Eyes Muralist on September 30th, featuring the art, performance, and food of the mission. Can you talk about Presita Eyes?
Sure. I mean, we just briefly mentioned Luis Cervantes, the abstract artist that I wrote about most focusing in the 50s. But of course, in the 60s, he met his partner, Susan Kelk, then, who became Susan Kelk Cervantes, who has really been a formidable representative of mural culture here in San Francisco, an incredible artist, very talented. Who created Presita Eyes initially with Luis, but I would say it's really her baby, and has not just blossomed herself as an artist, but has really helped so many other artists grow, especially within the world of murals. And so I would say, like, one of the things that I tried to capture was the ways in which nonprofits were really such a fundamental part of the mission. And Presita Eyes, starting, you know, with wherever trajectory you want to see in the 1960s or 70s, and then sort of thinking about all of these nonprofits that had been located in the mission that also faced some of the stresses of increasing property rates.
And you take us up to the present time and all of the gentrification. I mean, you try to end on a hopeful note, but there's been serious transformation of the mission through gentrification, and it's undeniable. And it's sort of like two worlds now. They're the worlds of the techies who live there and have moved in there, and then they're the worlds of the natives who still are part of that neighborhood who can afford to live in that neighborhood because of rent control or whatever. But talk about it from your perspective. I sound like I'm oversimplifying, maybe.
No, I mean, I think, you know, one of the I sometimes joke that I feel like I'm in exile living in Austin, Texas, you know, but one of the virtues is that I come back to San Francisco and the transformations, the cultural transformations are so much more vivid and perhaps also sometimes so much more painful because I find out who has lost their home or who has been displaced or what new stress people are facing on a very individual level. And then as a researcher, I have to try to, you know, look at this sort of structural impact of what does it mean to not have enough low-income housing for people or options? What does it mean to think the ways in which San Francisco was once such a space of migration for artists, for sort of people that had a kind of imagination of changing the world, and that a lot of the more recent migration has not been that, and that has really created a much more upscale sort of center of the city.
I may be taking too much of a jaundiced view of this, like my friend David Talbot, you know, who sees these things so divided. I mean, there is some dovetailing, some overlap between the tech and the arts community. My senior editor, Dan, for example, said, look at Burning Man. I mean, not all the tech people are rich by any stretch, and there are nuance and gray areas. But you also, before you write about gentrification in your epilogue and kind of stream it through the book itself, take us into Dia de los Muertos. And this is also a whole kind of chapter and segment unto itself. That is the AIDS epidemic and all that's associated with the politics of Dia de los Muertos.
Yeah, I'm really happy to talk about that. I mean, for me, you know, I mentioned my father originally from New Mexico, you know, and I growing up here, we celebrated Dia de los Muertos with all of his artist friends. And then my father would say, but I didn't really grow up celebrating this particular celebration, at least not in this way. And I had to think a little bit about what it meant to celebrate Day of the Dead, as English translation, in San Francisco. And how did Day of the Dead move from such a private, sort of intimate kind of remembrances of the dead, celebrations of the dead, to something that had sort of almost a parade-like effect within the mission? And so that was something that I was hoping to document.
Something you documented and captured quite well. And we're going to have some of our listeners in, joining us. We're going to a quick break here, but when we return, we'll hear from you again. Feel free to share your memories of the mission or any questions or comments you might have about that very vibrant area of San Francisco, still continuing to be vibrant in so many ways. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786 or email forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @kqedforum. Welcome to the program. When we return, I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Carrie Cordova. She's professor of American Studies and teaches Chicano Studies at the University of Texas, Austin, and has written a book called The Heart of the Mission, Latino Art and Politics in San Francisco. And a reminder that she'll be appearing at the Mission Cultural Center for Latino Arts on Thursday at 6:30 p.m. And I'm inclined, Carrie, before we go to calls and emails, to ask you, I open up asking about the Latin Quarter. I want to go into a little bit more with you. Chapter 1 opens, in fact, with a quote from the San Francisco tourism brochure, date 1940. Strolling out of Chinatown, you walk into another kind of world, the Latin Quarter, a world of intriguing little bookstores, bohemian restaurants, and Spanish, Basque, Mexican, and Italian shops. Well, there was a kind of international flavor to it, but it was beginning to establish itself in a very Latino way. And I'm struck by that because I'm looking also at a listener comment here who writes, being a native of North Beach, San Francisco, I'm familiar with change, not a fan. My question is this, before the Latinos, wasn't it the Irish that were the majority in the mission?
Yes, I think that the mission had a strong history of sort of ethnic working class communities. It was German. It was Irish.
How did it become so Latino, though, and especially like the Latin Quarter? How did that emerge?
Well, a contributing factor was white flight, actually, yeah. That a lot of people left the mission because the housing was far more dilapidated than in other parts of the city. And so you had a lot of families moving into suburbs. I mean, a sign of sort of, I guess, rising incomes, too, rising possibilities. But leaving an area that was steadily becoming more neglected, that was overcrowded with new migrants.
I'm looking at a comment here from Judd who writes, glad to hear the late Jose Ramon Lerma's name as you talk with Carrie Cordova about her book. Jose is a seriously underrecognized Latino artist whose life and work overlap with so many aspects of the Mission District and California Art Institute and culture. I miss him to this day. And you got a couple of really lovely paintings of his in your book. I mean, he was really an abstract painter.
Yes, he was a remarkable person. I'm wondering if that comment might be from Judd Hart, an also incredibly talented artist who worked with and was good friends with Jose. Jose, I mean, I feel like I have the honor of him having introduced my parents, so I owe him a heck of a lot, my life included. But I think writing about Jose was also an opportunity for me to sort of think about how he grew as an artist. One of the interesting things about Jose was his sort of his desire to be seen as an American artist, not simply as a Latino artist, not simply as a Mexican or Mexican-American artist. He grew up in the California Valley. His parents were farmers. He would want me to be very careful and not say like farm workers. They were farmers. He had a unexpected opportunity to become an artist. He had a really great teacher who opened his eyes and helped him get a scholarship to come to San Francisco at the Art Institute. And from there, he just took off. He was so inspired.
The Art Institute used to be called something else in those days.
The California School of Fine Arts.
Right.
Right.
Let's go to our callers. Let's go first to you. Carol, you're on the air. Good morning.
It's Carol with a T.
Sorry about that. Carol with a T. Go ahead.
Carol with a T. Carol. Anyway, my name is Carol Taniyama. I grew up in the Mission. I grew up on 24th and Folsom. And I also lived in Austin for a number of years, and I could never wait to get back to the Mission because it was like rejuvenating my soul. All right? But now I'm 57. I live in Fremont, and I can't stand to go to the Mission. And my family, my mother and father still live there. And it is so not the place that I grew up with. You speak about the Latin culture that was there, but there were also blacks, there were Asians, and there were some whites. But now when you go there, and I don't mean to pick on white techies, but that's all you see. And you got them with their overgrown baby carriages coming down the block and the dogs. And it's just, they came for the murals, they came for the weather, and now they've taken over. And the people that used to live there, that could afford to live there at the time, have been pushed out. And my family, by, you know, luck, work, and just being smart, were able to hold on to their property. But it's just not the same neighborhood.
Boy, you make it sound a bit like colonization. Is that how you see it when you go
there?
Well,
that's what it feels like. I mean, you know, I can remember when it first started happening, and you would see these younger white techs walking down the street, looking at their iPhones. They would never look you in the eye. They would never speak to you. But now they basically own the neighborhood, and they kind of look down on you if you're not one of them.
Well, I thank you for your recitation there, and I appreciate hearing from you. You want to comment, Carrie?
I do. I mean, Terrell, I get it. I feel it, too. I mean, I see a traumatized neighborhood, and I have to say, sometimes returning, I agree. I have those same moments of like both spiritual rejuvenation and also just extreme heartache, because I see so much that has changed and that has been sort of erased. And I think that was the objective of writing a book like this, was to say, like, look, this was here. These things happened here. And it isn't simply about redeveloping a neighborhood. That there's a culture here that can be acknowledged and should be acknowledged.
We'll acknowledge more callers. This is Anthony. He's calling us from the Mission. Anthony, go ahead.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Before anything, I want to thank everybody that is still fighting viciously to keep the Mission the way it was before. And also, what I want to say is that, you know, I get in really heated debates with people that lived there before, or they still live there, but they're old school cats like myself. I'm 35 now. I was raised there. I remember how these same people that are complaining used to make hell for the neighborhood. They were the ones that would be in the street corners and causing all kinds of trouble for everybody there. And now they're complaining how it changed. And to them, I want to say, what were you doing during those times to keep the culture and the community vibrant? And, you know, that frustrates me. Also, as an immigrant myself, how could I get mad for somebody migrating there for a better pay, for a better way of living? You know, so it's kind of hard. It's kind of being it'll be hypocritical of me to be like, you know, oh, go back to where you came from, where at the same time I get told that.
Hi, Anthony, I appreciate your expressing your view, and it's good to hear from you, and I thank you. Getting a lot of mixed impressions here of the Mission and how it's changed, which I like. I mean, one could say, is it safer? Is there less gang activity? I mean, those problems were certainly a big part of the Mission. Now that it's been more gentrified, you look at the police records and they seem to be not as serious or severe as they used to be. At the same time, there's been a depletion of culture. I mean, it's kind of both ways, isn't it?
Yeah, I think I would pick up on what Anthony said and just say that there are many people that are still there, you know, that people are still fighting the fight, and that there are many activists and artists who are still working in the area, still trying to hold on, and are not simply, well, I mean, I say that just to sort of acknowledge that not everything has been erased, and that we have made institutions there like the Mission Cultural Center, Presida Eyes, Brava, Galleria de la Raza, that really do matter in terms of thinking about keeping cultures alive.
And the murals are great. I mean, you know, the murals will stay there. They're not going to tear them down, I don't think.
No, though they do get dilapidated and then erased, which is also, I think, a struggle. In terms of not getting mad at someone for coming for better pay, sure, but that doesn't necessarily mean eclipsing the rights of people who have been living in those spaces. And so trying to think about ways, structural ways, not simply sort of heartache, but structural ways to make sure that we're not just kicking other people to the curb.
Again, we're talking to Carrie Cordova. Her book is The Heart of the Mission, Latino Art and Politics in San Francisco. And John, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi. I moved to San Francisco to attend the San Francisco State Art Department. This was in 1980, so I've been here for 37 years. But my wife and I both got our degrees in art, mine in photography, and Judy and my wife in sculpture. And I later was admitted into the graduate school, which had this wonderful, world-renowned teacher named Jack Walpott, who taught generations of really great photographers. Our state school had as many Guggenheim and NEA fellows as the San Francisco Art Institute.
You had some great people there. Did you know Dennis Beal?
Yes, I did. Yeah. And it wasn't just photographers. It was
yeah, he was a painter, too. Yeah. Right.
This teacher that I went to attend with this I considered him even then a living treasure. And then in the photography world, it was as hard to get into our graduate school as it was in any other. But he held his graduate classes, or we had the option to either go to state for the graduate thesis class or come to his home. And, of course, we all unanimously chose to go to this wonderful artist home and have our critiques in his studio, which was in the Mission District. And so generations of really excellent photographers had their critiques at the studio, and Jack made a point of if a photographer was in town for a lecture or an exhibit, most likely like Ruth Orkin or Jerry Yulsman, who he went to graduate school with at the University of Indiana, and the great teacher himself, Henry Holmes Smith, part of the new Bauhaus movement. And so this teacher who taught these generations of classes in the Mission District was one of the very first people in the history of fine art to have an MFA purely in photography as a recognized fine art, not part of the graphic arts department or any other painting department. But so he did this starting in 1960 at San Francisco State when it was called San Francisco State College.
John, it's good to have your memories and also to make that distinction about how San Francisco State really distinguished itself, because I was there, not in the 60s, but after that. And I thank you for that call. I'm looking at a comment from a listener who writes, interesting resonances with your work, addressing you, Carrie. I migrated from East Austin in mid-80s to San Francisco's Mission District following losing the Battle of the Hotels in East Austin. We were and are part of a bohemian fabric that stretches across time and space, always fraught with colonial pressures. What is next? Where does the new diaspora take us? That's that's one of the big questions. And let me bring more of our callers on here. We go next to Oakland and Leon. You're on.
Hi. I'm 47. I grew up in Berkeley and Oakland, and I went to the East Coast for college, and I took a Latin American studies class there, and the professor taught us about Chicano Park in L.A. and showed us the film. And I'm just curious if what was happening in L.A., was there any connection between what was happening in the Mission in terms of art and social justice?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, San Francisco and Los Angeles artists were constantly moving back and forth. You can... if you've watched the story about Chicano Park, then you know Yolanda Lopez was a central figure in sort of promoting the murals there. And, of course, she ended up here in San Francisco. And then thinking about Renee Yanez, her partner, and thinking about the ways in which he was such a fan of a group called Osco, performance artists in Los Angeles, bringing Gronk and sort of, and even thinking about Culture Clash, moving back a performance troupe, a comic performance troupe, very popular, very funny, moving back and forth between San Francisco and Los Angeles. You can see all of these threads.
Even though the cultures were so different.
Yes.
Let me thank you for that call, Leon. We'll go to more calls in just a moment. You take up a lot of photography, which John brought up, our caller before this, and film. I mean, you have, an expansive canvas here. And a lot of films have centered, documentaries as well as feature films.
Yeah, Mission. I mean, just going back to your caller, John, and sort of thinking, a lot of artists were starting to set up their studios in the Mission in the 60s. You can start to...
They could afford to live there then.
You could afford to live there. You could afford to have a gallery show there. You could, have your final MFA show there because it was an affordable space. And then sort of thinking about your other caller talking about what is next. I don't know, because the push is so extreme. I definitely see, as somebody who also lives in Austin, the ways in which San Francisco is almost like a template for so many other places.
Here's Valerie joining us from Boulder Creek. Welcome.
Hi, Michael.
Hi.
You bring my heart warmth talking about the old Mission. I graduated from Mission in 1950 and saw a lot of changes, lived there during the war. My dad had a gas station at 21st in Valencia, which is now that space is built up. And
do you remember the Latin Quarter then?
I do not. I knew that we had kids of Mexican heritage at Mission, but we call them Spanish.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know why, because they weren't. And when I went to James Look Junior High School, there were a lot of children bussed in from Hunters Point, the kids whose parents had come out to work in the shipyards. But in my time, my dad owned also a wine and spirit store at 508 Castro, which is in the heart of the Castro. And much of the ethnic background there was Italian. And there was a really good Mexican restaurant up 18th, just about a half a block from his store. But it was a time when the neighborhoods were very much almost like small villages. When we walked down Noe Street, all the kids in the neighborhood gathered, we'd go along, you know, start with one or two, and we'd probably have 10 by the time we got to school. We'd go across 24th, and that was a completely different little neighborhood. Yeah. And my dad's gas station at 21st and Valencia, or my grammar school on Church, Edison, we would, walk down all the steps on 22nd to go to school. But each of those little areas had quite distinct characteristics.
Just neighborhood to neighborhood, really, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Valerie, I appreciate very much your sharing those memories, and thank you for them. And it's lovely to hear from all these people who remember not only nostalgically but lovingly their time spent and their growing up in the Mission. Here's a listener who writes, I was born, raised, grew up in the Mission. I live in the same house my grandparents bought in the 40s. I work for the city, run a small wood shop on the side, and if it wasn't for my family owning this home, I could never live here with my wife and one-year-old child. All my neighbors, who are nice people, are techies, far wealthier than I and strongly opinionated on what needs to be fixed about this neighborhood. When I spoke to my father about the change in the city and the neighborhood even more, he reminded me the city always changes. However, the big difference is now the people who come only take culturally offer nothing, and instead of adapting and becoming a part of this neighborhood and city, they wish to change it into the frame of the generic places they came from. Another comment from Kimberly says, I personally love the Dia de los Muertos procession. Everyone has suffered loss and death. Why not take the traditions of another culture and become more educated and enlightened as a result? Many of the Latin merchants have shared with me that they don't consider it appropriation, but rather appreciation. There's another listener who says, the caller Terrell noted that the Mission is a very different place from his youth. However, he made it sound as if people were losing or having their homes taken from them. Aren't the majority of homes being sold by the owners at the current market rates? Isn't this more an issue of people capitalizing on the value of their properties? You want to get into that little nest of...
Well, we've just had several comments. So I might actually just go back to the Dia de los Muertos and say I understand what the listener means about appreciation versus appropriation. And I think that that is totally possible. And I think that that's actually one of the gifts of a special celebration like Dia de los Muertos, because we have in the United States so few opportunities to actually grieve for our dead in a public way. And so I think that that is really a tremendous asset for learning about something like Day of the Dead. And at the same time, one of the pressures that I tried to write about with that particular celebration was the ways in which a lot of people sort of came into it thinking it was another Halloween, dressing up, and sort of the parades became carnivalesque in a way probably not in tune with what is also still, in its heart, a very sort of religious or spiritual kind of celebration.
But a lot of the, and you write about like Carnival, a lot of these celebrations, yes, were centered in what was essentially, again, a Raza culture in the Mission. Here's a listener who writes, Holly, just a quick reminder from a native San Franciscan who grew up in the Mission in the 60s and whose native-born mother did in the 30s, the Mission wasn't always Latino. It was largely African-American, then Irish Catholic. Think St. Francis Fountain. My family was one of the few Jewish families. My grandfather owned Mike's Shoes on 24th Street, where the whole neighborhood bought their shoes, and I handed out candy to kids from a shoebox. Then his shoe store became a Latino-owned appliance store, washing machines and such, and now it's a trendy cafe. I wish we could preserve some of old San Francisco, especially the feeling of community. And let me bring some more callers on here. Ed joins us. Ed, you're on.
Yeah, hi. I did my senior thesis in college on the evolution, just to the point of the previous comment, about the evolution from an Italian-Irish to Latino and Filipino, and I used the church as a research mechanism there. So I interviewed priests and St. Anthony's and so forth, and St. Patrick's, and then really learned about, you know, when they started to do Mass in Spanish, which was obviously a key indicator of the critical Mass. But there's still pockets of, you know, Lucas on Valencia. There's an Irish florist on Valencia as well. And for me, it's just a part of the tapestry that's San Francisco and continues to be so.
And thank you, Ed, for that call. Good to hear from you. And here's Richard who writes, neighborhoods change, ethnic groups move out, and new ones move in. Why should only the current mission population expect that the neighborhood should be now set in stone?
Well, if I could just maybe speak for a moment, because I hear some listeners wanting to acknowledge the earlier history of the mission. It's Italian, German, Irish, Black. The mission has always been a very diverse population. And I thought initially when I was starting on my project that I was just writing about the mission of the 1960s and that Latinization. But it became all that much more important to try to understand the ways in which Latino residents did not just suddenly appear in the 1960s in San Francisco, that they had been living here a long time too, but because of real estate pressures, they had been pushed into a particular pocket, into especially the Mission, which seemed to somehow also make sense to San Francisco because it was next to the Mission Dolores. And so I think that there was even some sort of urban understanding of how to turn this neighborhood into a specifically Latino space.
Our guest is Carrie Cordova. She's professor of American Studies at University of Texas, Austin, and a San Francisco Mission native and author of The Heart of the Mission, Latino Art and Politics in San Francisco. She'll be appearing at the Mission Cultural Center for Latino Arts on Thursday at 6:30 p.m. And appearing on our program is our next caller, Brandon. Welcome. You're on.
Hi, Michael, and hello to your guests. I lived in Mission in the 60s as a child, and I just wanted to make the point that, you know, what's happened to Mission is just a microcosm of what's happened all over the city, as you know. When I was there, there was no BART. There were very few other immigrants. My mother was a Filipino immigrant, and she was one of only two Filipinos at her insurance company of 5,000 people. So things have really changed. I grew up in the city. I'm in East Bay now, but I love the Mission. I love the art. If we don't have the protections for the artists and the protections for housing, and unfortunately so many of the folks in the hotels and the old places have lost and been evicted, and you know, we have evictions and people who can't afford to live there. We have fewer artists.
Do you like it when you go back, Brandon?
I do. I'm saddened by the lack of diversity now, but you know, maybe we can get some big tech people to boost the arts and you know, really keep it going and you know, work at City Hall to save people.
That's a good suggestion. Thank you for that, Brendan. Actually, can you talk, Corey, a little bit about the impact of BART being built? It was pretty disruptive. It dug up Mission for years, displaced businesses.
Yeah. It did. I mean, basically, you said it yourself. I mean, I think the city sort of orchestrated the building of the 16th Street BART and the 24th Street BART station because it made sense in terms of easing commuter life. And understandably, I mean, and it's incredibly useful to us today. But at the time, it also meant digging up all the streets. It meant sort of plowing through Mission Street. And the construction took so long that a lot of businesses were displaced just at that very moment in time. And it was a sign of oncoming gentrification, even as the neighborhood was also dealing with all kinds of neglect.
And we'll deal with another caller. Let's go to Alhambra, California. Ray, join us. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning. You know, I've always enjoyed your shows. I've lived in San Francisco for 25 years. I just relocated to Alhambra, California, in Los Angeles. But I did want to just make a comment that, you know, the word to refer to all of us like mixed, you know, Hispanic kind of people is Hispanic, not Latino, and it just really sounds very kind of insulting to be called Latino. And even though I know a lot of people are very proud of it, I think it's very uneducated. And I really would hope that people begin to actually recognize the fact that we're Hispanics, we're not Latinos. You don't need to speak to me in my native language to let me know what my race is.
No, I appreciate that, Ray, although there are some who argue that the word Hispanic is a bit too ambiguous.
Word Hispanic was adopted by the U.S. government as a form of census taking. It is in no way any more natural than the use of the term Latino. And I think to get into debates about the names really misses the objective of trying to respect the cultures.
Well, respect your call, though, Ray, and good to hear from you. Thank you for that. Let's hear from Chris next. Chris, you're on.
Hey, how's it going? I grew up in San Francisco, and I went to school in the Mission Middle School at Horace Mann Middle back in the mid-90s.
Yeah.
And back then, it was a really rough area, and there was a lot of gang violence between, like, the Nortes and the Sereños. And I remember one time walking to school when I was in seventh grade, and one of the people had just graduated, ninth grader, I guess, saw me and recognized me, and he asked if I could hold his gun while he ran into Walgreens to get something for his mom. And I just kind of put my head down and said, I got to get a class. I'm walking. I can remember other incidences where there was, kids getting jumped and getting their money, their lunch money taken from them. So I remember when it was a lot more violent.
Boy, it's a sad note to end on in many ways, but a colorful one. And thank you all who called in with memories of the Mission. And again, you can meet Carrie Cordova on Thursday. She'll be at the Mission Cultural Center for Latino Arts. What about La Raza? Is that a better term than Hispanic or Latino?
La Raza sort of grew out of the 1960s, and it was meant to be inclusive. I think it's getting steadily displaced by Latino.
Thank you for being with us. Congratulations on your book. Appreciate the time you spent.
Thank you so much, Michael.
We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. And remind you that I will actually be substituted for it tomorrow by Scott Schaefer. Look forward to that. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation.